I am just really, really grateful to be here today. This morning already, I've had the opportunity to meet a number of people here from a variety of different places, and I just want to say, isn't it wonderful the visitors that we've had this summer? And we're so glad you're here. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I got to welcome some folks here from Louisiana today, and somebody managed to escape from Illinois and make it here today. And some of you from right here in our area, I know some folks are here to support friends and family for a baptism that's going to take place after the service today. And we just want to say welcome to all of you. I'm so glad that all of you are here today. Now, I don't mean to be funny in saying this. I want to introduce myself. I've been gone a lot this summer as well. My name is Steve Wimmer, and I'm the senior pastor here, and really, really delighted to be here and grateful to be here this morning. I want to ask you to picture this scene. Imagine that you are at the shore of the Mississippi River. And by the way, I have to use imagination here too. My only times ever seeing the Mississippi River are going over it at about 65 miles an hour, or faster if Dawn is driving. But I want you to imagine that you're standing at the shore of the Mississippi River, and as you look down carefully at the river, I am told that the mighty Mississippi will have a number of cross currents that you will see working their way across the top of the water. You will see currents that are cutting off to the left, and if you were to toss a piece of driftwood out there, you'd see currents that are cutting off to the right, and at various places, you'd see currents that create swirling waters on the top of the Mississippi River. I understand that if you look just at the surface of the Mississippi, you'll get the impression that it's a confused river, particularly in certain places, because the cross currents are going in so many different directions and doing so many different things. And if that is all that you knew about the Mississippi River, you'd think, man, this is one confused river. It doesn't know which way it's going. But of course, if you were to go deeper down into the Mississippi River, you would get in touch with the current that is carrying it. And all of those surface waters that are going in a variety of different directions are actually being carried along on a deeper current that is cutting its way smoothly and slowly and powerfully all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. The Mississippi River is sort of a metaphor of our lives. On the surface of things, we are all going so many different directions, this way and that way and swirling and cutting and going around, and at the surface we are going in so many different directions. But if we're able to get down deeper and listen to the deeper currents of our lives, the things that God is doing at the deeper levels of our lives, we become aware of a direction that is giving coherence and unity to all of our lives. This morning I want to speak about an ancient Christian and Jewish practice called discernment. Discernment is the practice of prayerfully sinking beneath the surface directions and currents of your life and getting down low enough to listen to and become aware of the deeper currents of God's Spirit at work in your life. I want to speak about this ancient practice of discipline, which is a getting down to the one thing that God is doing at a very deep level in our lives that unites all of the things that are happening at a surface level. Discernment is the practice of listening to God's guidance in an ongoing way over many, many years. Discernment is the practice of becoming sensitive to the leading of the Spirit. Discernment is the practice of becoming aware of what unites all of the apparently separate pieces of our lives. And discernment is an ancient and beautiful and powerful practice of the church. I hope that it goes almost without saying that churches need discernment, especially in days like ours when there are so many challenges and changes that are taking place. But today I really want to speak to us as the individual members of the church, the discernment that we need in our lives to become aware of God's leadership in the deep places of our lives. Our guide this morning is an ancient, ancient king by the name of Solomon. Solomon is about 20 years old as we look in on him today, and as you look in on Solomon, there is one word that I think summarizes the circumstances of his life at the time of this story. One word that summarizes the circumstances of Solomon's life is, ah! If ever there was a person who had reason to be anxious, it was Solomon. He's about 20 years old at the time of this particular story, and Solomon is at a time in his life when he ought to be thinking about who he's going to go out with on Friday night or how to put his most recent photos up on Facebook. Instead, Solomon is looking out over an enormous kingdom over which he is the ruler at 20 years old. Can you imagine? And it's not as though Solomon got to this place without struggle. It's not as though everybody on the planet wanted him to be the king. You look back in his history a little ways, and you'll notice that a number of years back, Solomon's half-brother by the name of Absalom had tried to steal the kingdom away from his father, their father, David. He had created a coup in which he had tried to wrestle the kingdom away from his father, David, and the coup had worked for a little while, but the end result of this thing was that this older brother, Absalom, had been killed, and David, the king over all of Israel, was now leading a nation as he was grieving the loss of a son. This is not exactly a story without political intrigue or family dysfunction. Those of us who think those are new things today. In fact, just before Solomon was recognized as the king, another brother had tried to usurp the place of the throne. He'd gathered a number of people around him, gotten some advisors, some people had announced that this other brother was now the king over all of Israel. And it was only because King David, who was dying, said, "No, no, 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 no. My choice is Solomon. I want Solomon to be the king." And it was only then that Solomon was recognized. And now, having arrived at this place through bloodshed and struggle and dysfunction and political intrigue, now Solomon is looking out over this enormous kingdom at 20 years old. It's not even 7 o'clock in the morning, and already one of his advisors is in his office, and his economic advisor is saying, "King Solomon, I don't know how to tell you this, but we've got problems. There are some things that David, your father, should have been taking care of during his reign, but he was just too old and too tired, and frankly, we need a lot of urgent help right now. Have you heard about the famine that's taking place up in the kingdom of Dan? We're going to have to get emergency relief to the farmers up there. We've got to do something for them. And have you heard about the strike that's taking place over in the kingdom of Benjamin? The garbage workers are on strike, and let me tell you, that place is really starting to stink, and we've got stuff that needs to be done. It's not even 7 in the morning. 8 o'clock in the morning, his minister of the Department of Defense steps in and says, "Solomon, I hate to bring this to you so early in the morning, but I know that we've had some recent military victories against the Philistines, but are you aware that they're already rattling their sabers? And to the east, the Edomites and the Moabites, they wish we weren't even here. And the Egyptians to the south, they've been quiet for a while, but King Solomon, you can't ignore the Egyptians. They are just waiting. They are just waiting to rumble. And it's not even 8 o'clock in the morning. 11:30 in the morning, his personal pastor finally comes into his office. Solomon looks at his watch, says, "You're a little late today, aren't you?" His personal pastor says, "Come on, we only work an hour a week." If ever there was anybody who had reason to be anxious, it was Solomon, 20 years old, called to be the king over the entire kingdom of Israel. And this little detail of the story is extraordinarily important. This story takes place in a context of worship. Solomon has left the palace, left his place of work, his office. He's gone up to one of the hills to offer 1,000 sacrifices to the Lord. I know this sounds strange to us, but in the part of God's story that this makes perfect sense. This is an act of worship. It's an act of extravagant worship on the part of Solomon. And then at night, as he settles down for what he hopes will be an unusually good night's rest, Solomon begins to dream. And in his dream, the Lord appears to Solomon, and the Lord says, "Solomon, I want you to ask me for anything that you want. Anything. Now here's his chance. Solomon could ask the Lord to change circumstances. Lord, I'd like you to obliterate the Philistines and the Edomites and the Moabites. I'd like to ask you to just simply crush the Egyptians. I want you to overcome all of our enemies that surround us and give us a time of tranquility." He could pray for church changes in his personal circumstances. Solomon has the opportunity now to say, "Oh God, come against all of my enemies. There are people who don't want me to be the king. Silence them from this moment forward." Anything he wants, Solomon can ask for. And instead, what Solomon prays for is a change in himself. Would you listen again to these words of Solomon's prayer? "You have shown kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son, me, to sit on the throne this very day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made me, your servant, king in place of my father David." Listen, please, carefully to these words. "But I am only a little child. I don't know how to carry out my duties." Literally, his words here say, "I don't know whether I'm coming or going. Your servant is here among the people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this people of yours?" In this moment of outrageous, overwhelmed challenge, the prayer of Solomon is, "O Lord my God, give me a discerning heart so that I will know what I should do." We're speaking about an ancient practice this morning, an ancient Christian and Jewish practice, the practice of discernment. We're talking about sinking down beneath the surface level currents of our lives and getting down to the deeper currents of our life, the deeper current, the single united current that gives coherence and connectedness to all of our lives. We're talking about discerning the guidance of God. One of the reasons that this is a challenging practice for us is because we find it very difficult, I believe, to distinguish between being called, who we are when we are listening to the guidance of God. We find it difficult to distinguish between being called and being driven. On the surface, they look extraordinarily similar, being called, responding to the guidance of God, living our lives non-anxiously, following God's leadership to us, and being driven, living anxiously with our teeth and our fists clenched and trying harder and harder and harder. On the surface, they look much the same, but in your experience and mine, we know them to be light years different. I'm going to ask you to imagine this scenario with me now, if you would. It's early in the morning, and your alarm clock goes off. You know, it's late summer now. We're past the middle of August. Sorry to announce that. The days are getting a little bit shorter. You can no longer trust the sunshine to wake you up early in the morning. And so the alarm goes off, and it wakes you out of a deep slumber. And very calmly, you reach over to your alarm, and you bang it against the wall a number of times. And you stumble up out of bed. And before you even make it into the bathroom, already your mind is beginning to spin over the things that you need to do. If you're a student, if this were the first week of school, if you're a student, your mind would be going to, what should I be wearing today? I wonder what my teachers are going to be like. I wonder how much homework they're going to be giving me to do this year. What's it going to be like to reconnect with my friends? What if I don't have lunch with the people that I want to have lunch with? Already your mind is beginning to go over all of these kind of things. If your list happens to be a domestic list, you haven't even gotten into the bathroom and already you're thinking, wow, I've got the laundry that needs to be done. There is that leaky pipe that we need to take care of. Goodness, the lawn is already long again. All of this rain means mowing more than once a week. I've got all that patchwork that I need to do before you've even started your day. Already your list is enormous. Or if your list has to do with work, you're thinking to yourself, ugh, my boss has been so demanding recently, and those people that I work with, I don't even like them. And already your list is beginning to develop of the things that you need to do and to accomplish and the challenges that you have. Now, pause with me, would you please? I'm describing the cross currents of the surface of our lives. And there's nothing wrong with these cross currents. It is not that they are the problem. In fact, these cross currents are just the stuff of our daily lives. This is the stuff of living. And Christianity, let's remember, Christianity, the faith of Christians is an incarnational faith. That means we believe that God invades this space And inasmuch as our hearts and minds are open to God in the daily tasks of our lives, then those mundane tasks become holy and spiritual when our hearts and minds are focused on God. The stuff is not the problem. The stuff going on the surface of the river is not the problem. This is not what makes us driven people. What makes us driven, I believe, is the voices that we're hearing from the sides of the river. And there are a couple of very, very powerful voices that I want to speak about just briefly this morning. One of them is a voice that you know very well. It is a voice that the Bible calls the accuser of the brethren. And may I add, the cistern as well. It is the voice of condemnation. It is the voice that is described in the book of Job as the adversary, the Satan. And it is a voice that you and I know very, very well. I hope that we are clear that this is not the same voice as the voice of God. This is the voice of the accuser. It is the voice of the one who hates God's people. And it is a voice that speaks always with condemnation. He has a very religious voice. I hope you know that. He has a very religious voice as he shouts at you and I from the side of the river. He may say, "Did you get up and pray for half an hour this morning? Good for you." He'd give you a little false pat on the back. "Now be sure that you don't fall short of that tomorrow morning, because if you only pray for 25 minutes tomorrow morning, you better make up for it the day after that." He's a voice that will make you very proud of yourself in one moment in order to set you up, in order to crash you against the rocks in the next. He has a very powerful religious voice. Please be aware of that. His voice is a perfectionist voice. His voice will say to you, "Are you doing a good job at work? Are you sure that you're doing a good enough job at work? Are you doing a good job as a parent? Are you sure that you're not doing a good enough job as a parent? You know, you really fall short if you think about it. Why is it that you're not as good as your neighbor at those things?" And this is important. He is a voice that will tell you to be something other than what you are. If you are a crab apple tree, and by the way, my wife says that I am one of those, except for the apple tree part. She cuts that off. If you are a crab apple tree, the voice of the accuser will say, "Why are you not an orange tree? Have you noticed how beautiful the oranges are? Your neighbor is an orange tree. You ought to be an orange tree instead of a crab apple tree." I'm describing to you a voice that is speaking sometimes subtly, sometimes manipulatively, sometimes very, very loudly, telling you that you ought to be something that you are not. And if you listen to his voice, you will be driven rather than called. Now there's another voice calling out from the other side of the river, I believe, at least as destructive as the one I just described. And this is the voice of your and my ego. This is the piece of us that is not satisfied to be loved by God and by the family and friends that we have. This is the piece of us that wants to be loved by everyone. And so this is the part of us that goes off and it says, if it feels good to be loved by a handful of people, how good would it feel if everybody noticed me and loved me? What would it be like if I were successful? What would it be like if I were the best person in my workplace and everybody else looked at me and went, "Ooh, look how good he or she is at what they do. What would it be like if I did things that gather acclaim from all of the people who are watching me? What would it be like if everybody loved me?" And so the ego puts up this picture of the person that I want to become and begins working toward that person. The problem is, that person is not really me. And so if I listen to this voice or this voice, I will be driven, constantly struggling to be something that I am not, constantly working to do better, constantly working to quiet that voice of condemnation, constantly working to become this false ego that I think that I need to be. And we will be anxious, and we will be driven, and we will be living with clenched teeth, and we'll be living with our arms and our hands clenched, and we will be anxious people. So I think that this business of discernment is so important, because particularly in the 21st century, I think we find it difficult to distinguish between being called and being driven. And so we're back to Solomon now. if ever there's anybody who had reason to be driven, it is a 20-year-old king who is looking out over a sea of things that need to be done and an army of voices who would love to tell him how to do it. By the way, let me pause for just a moment. If listening to this gives us a little appreciation for the challenges of leadership, perhaps it would also inspire us mercifully to pray for presidents and vice presidents and senators and congressmen who live with these sort of challenges every day. Here's Solomon with apparently the weight of the world on his shoulders, and his prayer is, God, I'm just a little child. I can't handle all of this. Give me a discerning heart that I may do justice for your people. It is a prayer that he might enter beneath the cross currents that are going 100 different directions. It is a prayer that he might go down to the deep places, the unifying leadership of God that carries all of the other along to one unified direction. It is a prayer for discernment. We should probably be clear here this morning about what discernment is not. Let's pause for a moment. Let's talk about what discernment is not. Discernment is not becoming perfect. Discernment is not always getting it right. Discernment is not waking up in the morning and saying, Lord, should I wear brown pants today or should I wear blue pants? Well, obviously, brown is the correct answer. Discernment is not perfectionism, where I suddenly become neurotic about every little decision that I have to make through the course of the day. God's leadership is a long leadership, and it is a loving leadership, and it is a beautiful guidance. And frankly, I'm not really sure that God is that concerned about the color of pants that you and I need to wear every day. And it is certainly not a guidance that makes us fearful and frightful that we might have missed something along the way. This is not perfectionism. Discernment is not arrogant knowledge. We need to say that. I actually heard about a pastor who gathered together his board at his particular church, and every time the board would meet, he'd set up an extra chair, and when people asked what the extra chair was for, he'd say, well, this is for Jesus. Now, that's wonderful. But then he explained, as we meet together as a board and have questions, I will ask Jesus what we're supposed to do, and he will tell me, and then I will tell you. That's not discernment. That's arrogance. That's power. That's not discernment. Discernment is not living fearfully, and it is not abdicating our responsibility to make decisions. We've known people like this. People have said, well, I'm praying about what the Lord will tell me, and then they never make decisions. I'm still praying, and they never make decisions. I'm still praying, I never make decisions. If you don't hear me say anything else today, please hear me say this. Christian people can have the courage to make decisions, because if we occasionally miss it, the grace of God is there to catch us in the very next step. We don't need to be more frightful of making decisions. We are more free. We can be more courageous because we're living in the mercy and in the love of God. Discernment is living with hearts and minds that are open. It is aware that beneath the many different cross currents of our lives, God is guiding us and directing us, and God is leading us. It is the voice of love that calls us forward and leads us on in new directions and into new places. And discernment is becoming more and more true to who we are. You will not become less you as you discern where God is leading. You will become truly you as you discern where God is leading. And so here's the prayer of Solomon. Lord, give me a discerning heart. Here's the prayer of Jesus. Do you remember early in the ministry of Jesus? Jesus had had this day in ministry early in the Gospel of Mark where everything had gone perfectly. It might have been the best day of ministry. It was a day in which he had preached the good news about the kingdom and lots of people had responded, and he had healed a number of people who had come to have their diseases healed, and he had cast out demons, and he had called some disciples who had responded positively, and it was a beautiful 24 hours in the ministry of Jesus early in his ministry. And then we're told the very next morning, they couldn't find him. The crowds in this village where Jesus had been preaching, the crowds were running around saying, where's Jesus? I've got this bum knee and I need some help. Where is he? And somebody else was saying, well, my son is sick and I need Jesus to heal my son. And somebody else was saying, well, I've got leprosy and I need to see Jesus. And all these people were clamoring for Jesus. And the disciples became anxious because all of these people were clamoring for Jesus. And they went running around like chickens with their heads cut off. Where is he? Where did he go? And finally, they found him. Alone. Listening. Praying. And one of the disciples said, listen to how anxious this is. One of the disciples said, Lord, where have you been? All the people are looking for you. Do you hear how anxious that is? And Jesus, who had spent the morning listening and discerning, said, we won't be going back to the people of this village. Think of all the disappointed people. We won't be going back to the people of this village because my Father has called me to preach the good news of the kingdom to all of the towns and the villages of Galilee. Jesus living his life in discernment. It is the psalmist, the words of the psalmist, teach me your ways, O God, and lead me in your paths. Discernment begins, I believe, with becoming fully present to the love of God. I cannot overstate how important that is. Discernment begins by becoming fully present to the love of God. This is not some squishy, feel-good, sloppy grace. I believe the truth is we are at our worst, and our churches are at their worst, and our cultures are at their worst, when they are not centered in the love of God and they're striving for all kinds of other things to meet their needs. I am at my absolute worst when I am an idolater and my life is not centered in the love of God. Discernment begins by being fully present to the love of God. I have a practice, and I hope you are finding some things that work for you as well, because they will be different for all of us. I have a practice on a daily basis where I open Scripture and I meditate on Scripture for a few moments, and then as part of my prayer practice, I'm just quiet. I don't speak any words during this particular time of praying. I just listen. And I don't listen for voices. I listen to become fully present to the love of God who has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. For me, this practice involves meditating on the simple word, yes. I become quiet and my heart becomes open and receptive as I simply repeat quietly again and again the word yes. Yes, which means my heart is open to you. My mind is open to you. I'm ready to receive your guidance in my life. I want to be very clear. I almost never hear voices telling me you should go do this or you should go do that. But what this practice does do for me is makes me aware that my life is centered in God's love. And I don't have to go about anxiously trying to accomplish the tasks of a pastor. Rather, my life is centered in him who loves me, and I'm free to be open to his guidance. I believe that discernment begins with being fully present to the love of God. I believe that discernment needs to happen at times in community. There are times when you and I become so confused, we simply can't even see what our own hearts are telling us. And we need the people around us who love us the most to speak to us, the people that are wise and discerning. I've told you this story before, but when Dawn and I were in Phoenix and we had the opportunity to come here to Alma, we also had the opportunity to go to a church in Denver to candidate at that church. It was a staggeringly difficult decision. We loved both of these churches. It was stunningly hard. It was so difficult that we couldn't hear what our own hearts were saying to us. And so we called together two couples, our closest friends, two of our closest friends, couples in Phoenix, and they just began to ask us questions. That's important. They didn't tell us anything for an hour and a half. They just asked question after question after question. What was it like when you interviewed here? What was it like when you talked to these people? What did you think about the community? What was it like when you talked to their leaders? They just asked question after question. After about an hour and a half of this, one of the ladies, one of the wives, said to Dawn and I, do you guys know that in every answer you give, you're saying Alma? And Dawn and I looked at each other and we said, we have no idea. And the other couple said, oh, it's as clear as a bell. This was discernment. People who are wise enough not to give easy answers, but to listen and ask questions and to help us hear what our hearts were saying when we ourselves could not hear. And the last thing that I want to say about discernment is about becoming you. Discernment is not about answering to God's call to another person. It's not about trying to become someone else. There's a wonderful old story about a Jewish rabbi, who said, in the day to come, God is not going to ask me, why were you not Moses or why were you not Joshua? In the day to come, God is going to ask me, why were you not Akiva, his name? Discernment is about becoming true to who you are. I'd like to close with this story, and I've shared this story before, but I really love what this story says. One of my favorite authors is a writer by the name of Chaim Potok. He is a Jewish author, a brilliant novelist. I discovered him when I was in my 20s at a time when I just really needed to hear what his stories described. He is a fiction writer. Many of his stories tell the story of people who are becoming true, people who are responding to the call to really be themselves. His narratives tell about people who are tempted to be something other than they are not, but then they eventually circle back to become who they are. They're beautiful stories. And I began to appreciate his stories even more when I heard about Chaim Potok's own story. Here is his story. When he was a young man, this brilliant young Jewish boy, his mother said to him, Chaim, you're smart, you're hardworking, you should be a doctor. And the young boy Chaim said, Mom, I'm not sure that that's for me. And years went by and he went off to college and his mother said, Chaim, you're brilliant. You make good decisions. You're gifted with your hands. You should be a doctor. And Chaim said, Mom, I think I want to write. I believe that writing is what I want to do with my life. He came back from college and she said, Chaim, why are you wasting your life? Why are you going off to rabbinical school? You should instead be going off to medical school. He said, Mother, I want to have a deeper understanding of my people, the Jewish people, because I want to write about them. I want to write. And when he finally graduated, his mother said, Chaim, you should be a surgeon. And Chaim said, Mother, my call is not to help people live longer, but to help people to live. Now, the point of that story is not that being a writer is better than being a surgeon. May I say, thanks be to God for the gift of healers. The point of that story is, it's better to be you than to be somebody else. And beneath the cross currents, the beautiful cross currents of our lives, there is a deep current that is calling us to be true to who we are. Discernment is a discipline that will take us the rest of our lives. We never get it fully. It will take the rest of our lives. Discernment is a discipline that listens as much to the doors that close behind us. Oh, that wasn't the thing for me, was it? Oh, that wasn't the thing for me either. Oh, that wasn't the thing for you. Discernment has as much to do with listening to the doors that close behind us as it does watching for the doors that open. And discernment is an art that we practice for the rest of our lives as we listen to the voice who's calling us to be true. I'm going to ask you if you would pray with me, please.